for the code of conduct, if you could just say that it is recorded but will not be published on the internet. I think that's required by the code of conduct of the convention.
Just so at right at the beginning?
Yeah. Okay. If you could do that, thank you.
Okay, so we got a... Hi, everyone. It's 7 o'clock, and my Swiss friends will be very proud of me, especially the train drivers, to be starting right on time. Maybe I'll give it a minute here, and I want to announce that this talk will be recorded, but not put on the internet, thank God. So I will still feel improvisational and unconstrained, which is a good thing that I love. So thank you for coming, especially at the, you know, at the evening hour here. Much appreciated. I want to talk, and how's the sound at the back if I do like this? You need more? No, it's good. Excellent. All right. The talk is called Time in the Novel, but it starts out with a little story I want to tell that I've told before. I told it even at WorldCon in 2006 in Anaheim. Some of you may have heard it, but there will be additions to what I spoke back then because I've had further information and thoughts about this particular topic. But it has to do with an unpublished correspondence between Virginia Woolf and Olaf Stapledon, our great science fiction genius of Liverpool. And the first letter is missing. It's from Stapledon to Woolf, but he was just writing a form letter to everybody that he could possibly get to sign a peace letter in the 30s, sometime in early 1937. And so the first letter is actually Woolf's reply, and she says, "Dear Mr. Stapledon, many thanks for sending me the letter. I was very glad to sign it, and I hope it will have more effect than such letters generally have. Many thanks. Thank you very much for saying that you have enjoyed my books. May I return the compliment? Yours sincerely, Virginia Woolf." So this being March of 1937, it's almost certain she must have been talking about Last and First Men, which made a big splash in 1932. And Virginia Woolf was, above all things, a literary person of the most intense curiosity and wide-ranging reading habits. So she probably had read Last and First Men. So the next letter, once again, the Stapledon letter doesn't survive. It was just a note, but he sent her Star Maker in 1937 when it came out, a copy. And, you know, this was a gesture by a man who, like maybe most of the people alive in England at that time, was super aware of Virginia Woolf as the leading literary person of her era. By 1937, she had been appearing almost weekly in the newspapers and in the Times Literary Supplement for over 20 years, and her novels were widely read and discussed, and so she was really famous and much beloved. So Stapledon sending her a copy of his Star Maker, I think, is one of those gestures that I myself can completely understand. And so a month or two later, he got this. "Dear Mr. Stapledon, I would have thanked you for your book before, but I have been very busy and I have only just had time to read it. I don't suppose that I have understood more than a small part. All the same, I have understood enough to be greatly interested and elated too, since sometimes it seems to me that you are grasping ideas that I have tried to express much more fumblingly in fiction. But you have gone further, and I can't help envying you, as one does those who reach what one has aimed at. Many thanks for giving me a copy. Yours sincerely, Virginia Woolf." Now that's a very nice letter to get, eh? Kind of beautiful. And after that, the last letter in the correspondence comes from Olaf Stapledon, so it's the only one we have from him. And he writes back a week later. "Dear Mrs. Woolf, it gives me great pleasure to know that you like my book and that some of the ideas in it fall in line with your own thought. The book falls very far short of my hopes for it, both in plan and expression, but I suppose that is almost inevitable. I have recently read The Years with delight and also with despair at the thought of the contrast between your art and my own pedestrian method. A wet and friendly sheepdog that has been swimming in the row has sprayed this paper with her tail wagging. Yours sincerely, Olaf Stegman. So I think it's kind of a little Virginia Woolf sentence, right, at the end there, to show that he had understood in reading her that these small details of ordinary life are important, given the differentials in their styles. And what I'm thinking is that Virginia Woolf really meant it when she said she was elated to read Star Maker. She was always interested to write history. And you see this mostly in her earlier career in her nonfiction, in her essays. If you read The First Common Reader, it's mostly history writing, and it's a way of going back into English history and exposing what people lived like in the Middle Ages, in the Renaissance, and in the Enlightenment period, by way of the writers that she enjoyed the most. And she managed to make almost everybody that she wrote about sound fascinating, that you had to go out and immediately read that reader and get the same thrill that she got out of it, and she conveyed that so beautifully that her nonfiction, the common readers and everything else she wrote in nonfiction form, almost the only literary criticism from the 1920s that can still be read with enjoyment today because of the fusty, idea-driven, abstract, painfully academic quality of most of the literary criticism of that era. When you read it, it just creaks. But Virginia Woolf's prose is still the best prose ever written, and her thinking is so clear and so generous. So, but in her own writing career, she had been one of the major discoverers of stream of consciousness. So the story I want to shift into now is a matter of form in the novel, and Virginia Woolf and Olaf Stapleton were both deeply interested in the forms of novels. And so I just start with that story as a way into this contemplation that I want to do now of what does it mean, the pace of narration, and what can we say about the limitations or the opportunities that are given by various kinds of narrative style that I want to name for you now. And a part of this comes from my teacher, Frederick Jameson's most recent book called The Antinomies of Realism, and his contention in that book, which he's very plausible in, and it's a kind of a wonderful exploration of literary history, is that what we call literary realism, which you could say Balzac, George Eliot, and that 19th century novel, that realism was an unstable transitional moment between the tales that came before, like Candide or Rasselas by Dr. Johnson, or even just folk tales, where you would tell somebody in anecdotal style a story, and therefore there was a certain pace to it that we'll rate later. But you could call it the conte in French, or you could call it the recit, that something's being recited. These are the French names for it that Fred uses. But also, we could say, I usually call it summarization and dramatization, as the way to distinguish these two very clearly, between the scene where you're reading it and it's like you're really there, real time. It's a scene, they call it that because of theater and the origins in, say, Henry Fielding, where you're actually reading it and it's happening right in front of your eyes, you're imagining it as happening. The scene is a new invention of the novel that begins to become more and more predominant in realism. But in realism, you get both. You get a summary of people telling a tale in anecdotal style, and you get dramatization, which is a scene that's being real-timed before you. And of course, if you've got real-time, thinking of this in movie analog terms, you might get into slow motion. So that what I quickly came to with my curious way of thinking about things, which is partially influenced by my hardcore chemist scientist wife, is could you calculate the speed of narration as a matter of minutes or days or years per page? So you can do a ratio, you can actually make a number. And that's why I call this a talk on the digital humanities, because usually the digital humanities means, you know, that they've used a computer to answer some question that you couldn't easily answer without a computer or a whole raft of graduate students, I might add, because concordances used to be written before computers came along. So it isn't as if that's impossible. You just need enough man hours and graduate students. But my digital humanities are the digits on my hand in making these calculations. So, but before I get to that part, there's more setup that I want to do. What Fred is saying is that in the 19th century, late 19th century, what modernism meant was the eventual complete triumph of dramatization over summarization, such that, and he said that's in order to express the modern city, in order to express affect, as Baudelaire did in poetry, these weird emotions that didn't quite have names, the feeling of being modern, that what you needed was stream of consciousness, at which point the narrator or telling a story becomes a bad thing to do. High modernism was stream of consciousness, was the banishment of the omniscient narrator and the banishment of just telling people things, because that was rude, crude. And this ethos in modernism got translated and vulgarized in the famous phrase, show, don't tell, which has dominated American MFA programs for the entire history of the MFA programs. Show, don't tell. Oh my God, you can't just tell the reader something. You have to show it to them, and then they will come to their own conclusions. So you can either say, he was furious, or you could say, he scrunched his face up and it turned red. But you'd better say, he scrunched his face up and he turned red, because you can't just say he was furious. You have to show, don't tell. Well, you can maybe tell. I can tell you, this is a stupid thing. It's a vulgarization of high modernism's valorization of dramatization over summarization, so that summarization went away from the art novel of that period. But there is more to say, because essentially you get a reaction against it of people who just want to tell, have a story told to them. So you get Edgar Rice Burroughs, where in one chapter of Edgar Rice Burroughs, like read Tarzan, 25 things happen to Tarzan in every chapter. And he, every paragraph is an adventure that Proust could have unpacked into several volumes. This is the high-low split in popular literature and high art literature in the high modernist period. Rude, vulgar, stupid art would do telling, and high, serious, important, and teachable in the university art would do showing. So you show, don't tell as an MFA statement. The speeded up, of course, Tarzan. The slowed down, think of Joyce, Ulysses, and Stream of Consciousness. You have a 24-hour period. It takes 800 pages to tell it. That is about a minute per page. And this is set the gold standard for what real literature should be doing in the modern period. And so Virginia Woolf was the co-inventor of Stream of Consciousness, along with Dorothy Richardson and James Joyce. And there's a story that could be told about Virginia Woolf reading Henry Thoreau's journal to review it for the TLS when it got published in 1906. So this is Virginia Stephen. And of course you don't read all of Henry Thoreau's journal, because it's 2.5 million words in 14 volumes. And if you're reviewing it for the TLS, you poke around a little bit and get a sense of it. Well, you poke around in Thoreau's journal and you come to pages where he'll say, I am sitting on the log. The moon has just come up. It smells like mushrooms. And then I have dropped my pencil and I can't find it. I'm thinking, now wait, how did he write that sentence? But his father was a pencil maker, and so he might have had a whole pocket of them. But what I'm thinking is, shortly after Virginia Woolf wrote her review of Henry Thoreau's journal, she wrote The Mark on the Wall, and Monday or Tuesday. And then she wrote Jacob's Room, turning it into a novel. So I think that Virginia Woolf, in discovering and inventing Stream of Consciousness, also might have gotten a little tip-off from America's greatest prose stylist, and the two greatest diary writers in the history of literature, Virginia Woolf and Henry David Thoreau. So Virginia Woolf had made her mark on the wall with Stream of Consciousness, but she was very interested in telling history also. So structurally, she in To the Lighthouse, she needs to have a 20-year break in the middle of the story. And she has a short chapter called Time Passes. So let me read you just briefly a little bit from that. So with the house empty and the doors locked and the mattresses rolled round, those stray heirs, advanced guards of great armies, blustered in, brushed bare boards, nibbled and fanned, met nothing in bedroom or drawing room that wholly resisted them, but only hangings that flapped, wood that creaked, the bare legs of tables, saucepans, and china, already furred, tarnished, cracked. What people had shed and left, a pair of shoes, a shooting cap, some faded skirts and coats and wardrobes, those alone kept the human shape and in the emptiness indicated how once they were filled and animated, how once hands were busy with hooks and buttons, how once the looking glass had held a face, had held a world hollowed out in which a figure turned, a hand flashed, the door opened, in came children rushing and tumbling, and went out again. Now, day after day, light turned like a flower reflected in water, its sharp image on the wall opposite. Only the shadows of the trees flourishing in the wind made obeisance on the wall, and for a moment darkened the pool in which light reflected itself. Or birds flying made a soft spot flutter slowly across the bedroom floor. Nothing, it seemed, could break that image, corrupt that innocence, or disturb the swaying mantle of silence which, week after week, in the empty room, wove into itself the falling cries of birds, ships hooting, the drone and hum of the fields, a dog's bark, a man's shout, and folded them round the house in silence. Once only, a board sprang on the landing. So I would say this is stream of consciousness with no consciousness there. So, and it also represents a problem that she solved by a very beautiful prose poem of about 20 pages that goes on like that. I particularly like the idea of a board springing, the nail giving loose under the force of gravity or the wood drying out. But she's looking and trying to think, how do you convey 20 years passing in an old house when nobody's in it? But she wanted more, and every novel that she wrote was an attempt to find more ways to talk about deep time, the impact of the past, English history. It was a desire of hers throughout. And then Stapleton sent her Star Maker, as said. And let me remind you here of a typical passage from Star Maker. The life of the individual star is not only a life of physical movement, it is also undoubtedly in some sense a cultural and a spiritual life. In some manner, each star is aware of its fellow stars as conscious beings. This mutual awareness is probably intuitive and telepathic, although presumably it's also constantly supported by inference from observation of the behavior of other stars. From the psychological relations of star with star sprang a whole world of social experiences which are so alien to the minded worlds that almost nothing can be said of them. Useful. There is perhaps some reason for believing that the free behavior of the individual star is determined not only by the austere canons of the dance, but also by the social will to cooperate with others. Certainly the relations between stars is perfectly social. It reminded me of the relation between performers in an orchestra, but an orchestra composed of persons wholly intent on the common task. Possibly, but not certainly, each star executing its particular theme is moved not only by the pure aesthetic or religious motive, but also by a will to afford its partners every legitimate opportunity for self-expression. If so, the life of each star is experienced not only as the perfect execution of formal beauty, but also as the perfect expression of love. The physical nature of a star at any stage of its growth is in part an expression of the telepathic influence of other stars. This fact can never be detected by the pure physics of any epoch. Unwittingly, scientists derive the inductive physical laws of stellar evolution from data which are themselves an expression not only of normal physical influences, but also of the unsuspected psychical influence of star on star. That's our Stapleton, right? The ultimate space cadet, the visionary, the super clerk, the man from God. He's really, I think, one of the handful of greatest science fiction writers ever, and I was really proud to be on the board of people that selected the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, because as a kind of ridiculous statement about the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Stapleton wasn't in it until last month. But now he is. So justice has been done. Yes. So there's a couple more things I want to say before I get to the calculation. So Virginia Woolf, she wanted to talk about deep time. She had stream of consciousness as her method. So in her last novel, she struggled mightily, and the technique that she came upon, the form that would express this content, because the content of the form and the form of the content are things we need to think about. The form she decided to choose was a summer festival play, a drama that a woman dramaturge is trying to organize in the summer on the Sussex Downs in the 30s. And it's going to tell the entire story of England from beginning to end. And so every night, nobody understands her. Her performers don't understand her. Her audience doesn't understand her. Nobody understands her. And every night she goes to the bar and drinks herself into a stupor, thinking, this is just terrible. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And that never resolves for her. And meanwhile, there's family dramas going on in the houses nearby. And so these are the last pages of fiction that Virginia Woolf ever wrote. Lucy slipped her letter into its envelope. It was time to read now her Outline of History. So we know who wrote that, right? Our H.G. Wells, Outline of History. H.G. Wells, The Outline of History, a world history in two volumes, a massive bestseller. But she lost her place. She turned the pages looking at pictures, mammoths, mastodons, prehistoric birds. Then she found the page where she had stopped. The darkness increased. The breeze swept round the room. With a little shiver, Mrs. Swithin drew her sequin shawl about her shoulders. She was too deep in the story to ask for the window to be shut. England, she was reading, was then a swamp. Thick forests covered the land. On the top of their matted branches, birds sang. The great square of the open window showed only sky now. It was drained of light, severe, stone cold. Shadows fell. Lucy turned the page quickly, guiltily, like a child who would be told to go to bed before the end of the chapter. Prehistoric man, she read, half human, half ape, roused himself from his semi-crouching position and raised great stones. She slipped the letter from Scarborough between the pages to mark the end of the chapter, rose, smiled, and tiptoed silently out of the room. The old people had gone up to bed. Last testament of Virginia Woolf in fiction, but I just went over to the National Portrait Gallery yesterday to see the exhibit on her that's there. And at the end of the exhibit is a type letter she wrote to John Layman, their assistant at Hogarth Press. She says, I have just reread my so-called novel, and I have decided that it does not do. Leonard doesn't agree, and so I'm asking you to read it and break the tie and make the judgment whether to publish or not. I do not want to publish it. John Layman getting this letter must have freaked. I mean, I think his book about that period was called Feeding the Wolves or Getting Eaten by the Wolves. Anyway, it was a tough job. And I forget how he answered it. He probably said, yes, we need to publish this book. You know, it's already in the schedule. But Virginia Woolf went into a depression and shortly thereafter went down to the River Ouse and drowned herself. So there's one version of this story, which is Virginia Woolf discovers science fiction, tries to write science fiction, fails and kills herself in despair. It's not the right story. It's not the total story. There were other things going on. She had suffered probably bipolar. She had suffered episodes of depression before. She had begun hearing voices. What happened was that World War II had already begun, and they were down there near Brighton. German planes were flying overhead every day, sometimes getting shot down and crashing in the fields around them. Leonard Woolf was Jewish, and they had cyanide in the garage, and they were going to kill themselves if the Germans invaded, which is expected. They were in Hitler's Black Book, which is also on display at the National Portrait Gallery, a list of 2,500 English people that were to be immediately arrested and presumably sent off to the camp or executed if this invasion was successful. And then also there was rationing. And Leonard Woolf had discovered that if he kept Virginia plump, heavier than 150 pounds, by making her drink a glass of whole milk in morning and evening, she was much more stable in her moods. So empirically, as an attentive husband, and a little dictatorial at times, he just found that he was helping her by having her keep her weight a little up. It's been confirmed that there's probably some biological validity to this opinion of his. But in the rationing of World War II, you couldn't get whole milk anymore. So at one point, Vita Sackville-West, who is, of course, a close friend of Virginia Woolf's, had a farm with some cows, and so sent over a 3-pound lump of butter. And in her thank you note to Vita, Virginia Woolf, in describing the lump of butter, is, I think, hallucinating. Her description of it is even more hyper-real than usual in her writing, more precise, more... You know, the thing is vibrating. I think she says it's like vibrating on the table. She was deprived of fat that she needed in her diet, and she began to hear voices again, which was the prominent sign of her mental troubles when she was younger. And she didn't want to be a burden, and there was the war and blood, and she had just written this book she didn't like. Always a bummer, I can tell you. And so that's the story of Virginia Woolf's suicide. It's a complex matter of several tide lines hitting all together to make a kind of a super low tide. So you go down, actually the National Portrait Gallery has the cane that she left on the riverside, so Leonard knew exactly what had happened, although they didn't find her body for 3 weeks. And people were devastated all over England. They published many books about her, and one of them is Memories of People Who Knew Her. Another one is all of the sympathy notes that Leonard Woolf got, and his replies, because he replied to every one. It's a very moving volume. So, to get back to the formal part of our talk, there's one more mode. There isn't just summarization and dramatization. One of the biggest impacts on Virginia Woolf in her writing life, and more so even than Stapleton, who was a late find and one book, and an oddity that she didn't even think was fiction, was Marcel Proust, whose books were being translated in English, but I believe Virginia seemed to be reading them in French. And Proust's novel it blew everybody's mind, but Virginia Woolf loved this novel. She didn't like Joyce's Ulysses. She thought that it was vulgar and people make fun of her being so high class, but she also thought that it was incoherent and boring, and an experiment that had some good chapters and some bad chapters, which, believe me, if you read Ulysses, I think you have to agree. Some of those chapters are as funny and as good as literature has ever been. Other chapters, it's like, okay, I need to be over with this. But she loved Marcel Proust's novel, and it's Gerard Genette. I mean, Proust has gotten the best criticism of any novelist ever. Every great French philosopher of the 20th century has had to write an entire book on Proust just to prove that they could do it. And some of them have had some tremendous insights. And Gerard Genette wrote a book called, in English it's called Narrative Discourse. I recommend it to you. He describes every single strategy that the novel can have. He does an anatomy of the novel in formal and structural and writing terms. And his one example for every single thing is Proust's novel. Proust's novel serves as an example of everything the novel can do. And it's a, you know, it's a very funny book of criticism, because as you realize what Genette is going to do, you can't help but laugh. But one of the things that Genette pointed out is that Proust has a tense in French that he can use that English doesn't have quite an equivalent of, but the method is perfectly comprehensible in English, which is this. You say, we used to do this, we would, so it's that subjunctive, we would go out and down to the river every day and have a picnic. Well, that works okay. But what if you say, we would go down to the river and trip over the fourth treble from the left and then see that there was a line of ants to the right. We would sit down on a picnic thing that we ripped when we sat down on it. In short, a lot of Proust is done in a mode that says this happened all the time, but his description is so detailed that you can't believe that it ever happened but once exactly like that. So Genette calls this the pseudo-iterative. It's iterative if it happens over and over again the same way. But since you can't ever walk in the same river twice, there's never a true iterative. So Genette makes up this term, the pseudo-iterative. You put it in and say, we would do this. You give details. And yet the implication is this is like a variation on a theme that happens over and over again. You can begin to write about habitual life. And the pseudo-iterative, believe me, has been a godsend in my career as a novelist, because I want to talk about the content of the form here. What telling and showing are all about, what I think novels, what we want out of novels, is on the one hand, to be in other people's lives and minds. So you want a kind of telepathy or a little bit of social anthropology. You want to know, what was it like to live in Florence in 1328, and go down to the square and see somebody get burned at the stake? What was it like to live on Mars in the year 20,800 and have to live underground all day because there was no atmosphere. What was it like? And what did people think? And how did they feel? We want ordinary life out of novels, but we also want plot. We want a story. And so what I'm thinking is what happens is you have ordinary life going on in the novel, ordinary life, you're learning it, it's great. You're thinking, come on, you know, I'm not really an anthropologist. Something goes wrong. When ordinary life goes wrong, we call that plot. Things go awry. And so you get both. So novels are made up of both. And so the telling part is usually a matter of giving you ordinary life or history. The showing part is usually the thing that is interestingly odd, where things have gone wrong. And this explains the attraction, by the way, of those detective series where you have the same detective and he lives in Iceland or he lives in a Roman monastery in the year 1400, and the detective is always figuring things out, and there's a series. There needs to be 10 or 12 books. This book starts with a thing going wrong. And then the detective figure, in figuring out what went wrong and why, reveals to you ordinary life, what would have been ordinary there. So you get immediately plot. You get that immediate kind of fix, that drug high of, oh my God, there's a crisis. And you're turning the pages as fast as you can. But meanwhile, you're also learning, oh, this is how they lived in Inca Peru at Machu Picchu, you know? Or this is how they lived at the bottom of the sea in the underwater tank. So the pseudo-iterative is very, very important. But it wasn't noticed by high modernists. And what happened, I think, in the high modern period was that, A, after World War II, academia got its hands on it, English departments. It was the only way to be, and they could teach it, and it was suddenly an activity that had been Protestant activity. It was like between you and your book, and you could just commune with it, and it was great, and suddenly you needed a priest to explain it to you. So suddenly literature became Catholic in high modernism. And notice that Virginia Woolf's book, The Common Reader, she valued that immediate transmission of writer to reader with nobody in between to interpret or explain. So we have this moment in high modernism that I call the slower than Proust contest. If slow is good, then slower is better. And if fast is bad, then faster is worse. So comic books are obviously crap. You can't like a book that only has about, you know, 500 words in it and a bunch of pictures. That's got to be correct. Whereas if you go slower than Proust, and by the way, we'll get to the quantitative part here. There's a 250-page garden party in Proust that only lasts about 2 hours. There is an opening in one of those volumes where Marcel wakes up, gets out of bed, goes over to the window, and looks down at their servant, what's-her-name, killing a chicken. That takes like 50 pages of him getting up out of bed and looking out the window. So going slower than Proust was A, hard, and B, a terrible idea. And so people began to write about the exhaustion of literature, or the literature of exhaustion. They had it both ways. The 50s, the 60s. Oh my God, every story's been told. And what they were really saying is, we can't go any slower, you know? We're just gonna die, or freeze on the page. But they tried anyway. And so you get John Barth, you get John Gardner, you get late Nabokov, who was a tremendous writer, and yet nevertheless, he was in this period of going slower than Proust. You read Ada and you're thinking, come on, Vladimir, we know you can write better than that. How slow do you go? And there was a whole vibe, a meme in American popular culture, and I don't know if it was over here, but since Leavis and Trilling were heavily culpable for this high modernist priesthood. It probably was true over here also, and indeed British literature in the 50s, British fiction in the 50s was kind of dreadful, except for our wonderful science fiction writer William Golding, who arrived like a bomb in the middle of British literature and blew everybody's minds because he was so much better than everybody else because he did genre, and he went fast. But meanwhile, in the late 60s, everybody's going, oh my God, we can't get any slower, literature must therefore have died. And then in America, suddenly in English, written and published first in 1968, but translated into English in 1970. Colonel Aurelio Buendia organized 32 armed uprisings and he lost them all. He had 17 male children by 17 different women and they were exterminated one after the other on a single night before the oldest one had reached the age of 35. He survived 14 attempts on his life, 73 ambushes, and a firing squad. He lived through a dose of strychnine in his coffee that was enough to kill a horse. He refused the Order of Merit, which the President of the Republic awarded him. He rose to be Commander-in-Chief of the Revolutionary Forces with jurisdiction and command from one border to the other, and the man most feared by the government, but he never let himself be photographed. He declined the lifetime pension offered him after the war, and until old age he made his living from the little goldfishes that he manufactured in his workshop in Macondo. Although he was always fought at the head of his men, the only wound that he received was the one he gave himself after signing the Treaty of Neerlandia, which put an end to almost 20 years of civil war. He shot himself in the chest with a pistol, and the bullet came out through his back without damaging any vital organ. The only thing left of all that was a street that bore his name in Macondo. And yet, as he declared a few years before he died of old age, he had not expected any of that. On the dawn, he left with his 21 men to join the forces of General Victorio Medina. "We leave Macondo in your care," was all that he said to Arcadio before leaving. "We leave it to you in good shape. Try to have it in better shape when we return." Arcadio gave a very personal interpretation to those instructions. Well, we know this book, 100 Years of Solitude. There is not a single dramatized scene in that whole novel. There was no dialogue. There are scraps that are remembered because they were so telling. "Leave the town the way I gave it to you." Or Ursula, the grandmother, saying, "If you two marry, your kids are going to have pig's tails." But there's never a dialogue. There's never a scene. And so, and yet this is one of the greatest novels of the 20th century. And everybody immediately recognized it. And believe me, the talk about the exhaustion of literature, it ended the next day. No one ever spoke of it ever again. It had been knocked aside because nobody could deny that it appeared that literature was not dead in Latin America. So if it was true there, it might be true anywhere else. And indeed, immediately, people said, "Well, heck, if you can do it in Latin America, I'm going to do it for India." And so you get Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. And then there were bad category errors. He said, "Well, if you can do it in Latin America, then you can do it in New York City," which turned out not to be true. Didn't work. Because magical realism was about the developing world, was about the strange, magical, realist world of Latin American history in the 20th century. You put it in New York City, and it just looks stupid, because modern industrial society is not what magical realism is about. What you need for New York City is science fiction, of course. New York City is tranquil. So science fiction is the appropriate genre for the developed industrial West, and it's why it's so popular here and why it was written here. Magical realism was the great invention of a group of a couple dozen people in Latin America in those years. So I think this leads me finally to my wonderful digital humanities moment. Oh my God, I'm going to have to do this all out of my memory. That's okay, because it's almost all made up anyway. Let's think about the fastest that you can go and set a benchmark. Thinking that the day novel is maybe a minute per page, real time, you can think about real time. If I read a passage alone, a scene aloud, it usually takes 2 minutes per page. Like if you're reading fiction, you say, "Oh, 2 minutes per page." So 2 minutes per page, whatever. But how fast can it go? Well, I mean, Edgar Rice Burroughs is a great example, and of course, there's many speedy people. But let's talk about the greatest example, which is William Golding. His novel *Pincher Martin*, which is a superb novel. A man crashes on an island in the North Atlantic. He's the only survivor. He struggles to survive. 2 weeks go by. He tries everything. And then in the last page you realize actually he had drowned in the sinking of the ship. And the entire 200 pages of the novel is what he's thinking in his last, say, minute. So in other words, 200 pages describes 1 minute of his drowning. Therefore, you get about a third of a second per page. So we're going to say that's as fast as fiction can go, even if there's a little trick involved. I still want you to give me that one because, you know, it's literally true, even though it's seldom written up that way. But, you know, there are examples of people, you know, going into that slow-mo mode and describing in great detail. Claude Levi-Strauss spends 30 pages describing a 10-minute sunset, et cetera, et cetera. It's a thing people do. It's an experiment. Now, at the other end, we can just go back to Star Maker. Star Maker is the story of the universe from now until the end of the universe. Well, that's great, and it's also 200 pages. So then how long is the universe going to last? it's a point of contention among scientists. It's not exactly determined. Depends, and now we're all messed up because dark matter, dark energy, we don't have any idea, really. But there's been some guesses out there. Like, you know, the Big Bang, 13.82 billion years ago. Well, that 0.2 at the end there, that's getting pretty precise. That's like within a million years. And so that's pretty impressive. The end of the universe, I've seen different figures, but I'm going to pick the one of 75 billion years because it's kind of mind-boggling. And Stapledon tells that whole story. So that is 500 million years per page. Pretty damn good, huh? And when he's doing his telling and showing, every once in a while Stapledon will slow down. He'll tell the story of a civilization, and it takes 5 or 8 pages to tell the story of that civilization or that species. And then he goes back to his speed mode where he's telling you, you know, what happened in this galaxy and that galaxy. So he even has changes in speeds. But the book as a whole, 500 million years per page. Now, the differential. And here's where I had to really get into the digital humanities and use a computer. His name is Lisa Noel, my wife. Because there was some complex math involved, which I mean multiplication and division. That as hard as I tried, I did not trust my responses. But I've confirmed by one of the strongest computers on this planet that the differential is 47 trillion to 1. That's a big number. That's fiction. That's the power of fiction. Movies can't do that. Only novels can do that. 47 trillion to 1 between the fastest speed and the slowest speed in recorded novelistic history. My Lord. I try to imagine, you know, Astor Piazzolla, the great Argentinian bandoneon player, when he's playing, like the BBC recorded him playing in Bristol, he had his knee up, he'd play his bandoneon, he'd go down, and then he'd squeeze it back up. There are fingers on both sides of the bandoneon, and whether he's squeezing in or out, the different buttons play different notes. I mean, it's like the hardest instrument in the world to learn, but he had been playing it since he was 5, and it was like part of his body. So I'm thinking about the novel, but then the accordion goes 47 trillion times farther out than when it's closed. That's a great instrument. You've got to love fiction for that incredible power. So, what do we do with it? I guess that's one of the questions that we could have. But let me gather myself and see what I was... Ah, yes, the return of telling. So, there's a couple of things to be said about that. Telling came back a lot in science fiction. Sometimes eventually when we got overawed by modernism, we started talking about, oh, well, you can't just tell people things. You can't have an expository lump. You can't have an info dump. And I will, save my rant on the info dumps for the info dump panel tomorrow or Saturday, because it's a little bit extraneous here. But science fiction was a place where you could tell people things. You could do summarization. And then it went away, and we had to be like everybody else and try the slower than Proust contest, which was part of science fiction's new wave experiment. And it got some very good books out of it, but it was really a bad idea because science is about exposition. If you take exposition out of science fiction, you make it less scientific. You make it less information rich. And information was part of the fun of science fiction. So that was one problem with this high modernist moment. The other thing I want to say is that my great teacher, Damon Knight, he used to say, well, how do you choose when to summarize and when to dramatize? And he said, it's pretty simple. In the exciting parts of the story, you slow down. In the boring parts of the story, you speed up. It makes great sense. And it's been the rule of thumb for many and many a fine novel in our field and any other field. But I noticed recently something very, very peculiar, which is Patrick O'Brien, the great novelist, whose Aubrey Matron series is a single novel, 6,000 pages long, which, of course, in the world of Robert O'Jordan is like nothing. It's like half of a Jordan. But it really is one novel, and it's one of the best novels of the 20th century. And what I was noticing is that he does it almost exactly backwards, that he slows down in the boring parts, or what you would call the boring parts, and it makes them interesting, because you're getting real life in the British Navy during the Napoleonic Wars in all its texture and character. And it wouldn't be as interesting if you had less information. It's the slowing down, it's the richness of information that makes daily life on the blockade interesting. Then something exciting happens, and bam, he jumps at it like a horse going over a fence after a fox. The action sequences in Aubrey, in the Aubrey Matron series are sometimes set up such that a battle that you've been waiting for sometimes two volumes, sometimes 20 chapters, will come across and it will take 3/4 of a page and it's over. But in that 3/4 of a page, you have been really there. You've been excited. It seems to follow the pace of life. So in this sense of flow, of this back and forthness, there are maestros like O'Brien who are doing counterintuitive things that nevertheless work well. And I guess that's what I want to come to, is this idea that show, don't tell is a zombie idea. It was killed in 1970 by Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude, but it still staggers ignorantly around the landscape of MFA programs, of writing workshops, of fan response groups, of the world in general thinks that literature is about show, don't tell. There could be nothing more zombie dead than that idea. So let's bury it, put the stake through the heart. I know that's the wrong, you know, criminal, but you don't want to judge a book when it goes into summary mode and say, oh, the writer's being clumsy. Oh, the writer didn't know how to make this into, oh, the writer didn't know how to hide the details. There are now phrases that I've forgotten about how you hide the details. It's not just Easter eggs, but Teresa Nielsen Hayden used the phrase earlier today of you put in one phrase of information and then you quote about Heinlein's The Door Dilated, as if that's supposed to be incredibly great that the door dilated and you're left wondering, well, why, how? I want to know what the story is of that door, and yet you don't get to hear that story. You go back to the car chase. You go back to the man with his hair on fire running through the room. You go back to plot. And I'm thinking, plot, plot, plot. Car crash, car crash, car crash. I mean, give me a break. What I want is texture and detail and something new and interesting. So we need to have more tolerance. And what I also like as an invention of my own that has completely informed my writing since Red Marms is the idea that these are just sentences on the page. There's no rule that you have to keep it summarizing for a paragraph. There's no rule that you have to give a complete scene. What you can do is begin to play that bandoneon in radical ways so that sentences alternate between summary and dramatization. You can get weird mélanges, and then there's also the pseudo-iterative. We used to do this. We would do that. How do you tell the story of 200 years in one novel? This was the problem that I was faced with the Marx books. Well, I didn't know, and not only that, but if you're going to tell 200 years, what single incident is important enough to report upon? Well, I woke up this morning and I had scrambled eggs. Are you going to put that sentence in a novel that has to cover 200 years? I don't think so. On the other hand, how are you going to get daily life into the novel if you don't do something like that? So you need the pseudo-iterative, you need dramatization, you need summarization, and if you can work the gear shift box, if you can squeeze the bandoneon back and forth, you can have rhythm, you can have flow, and you can take the reader through something that is not just metronomic. So now when I read a novel and I realize that the novelist is going to give me a scene, and then another scene, and then another scene, and the narrator's going to be hidden, and there's never going to be a judgment or a generalization or a summarization, but it's just going to be scene after scene after scene. It's as if the symphony starts to play and they put a metronome up on the conductor's box, and the metronome is set to 80 beats per minute. Toop, 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 toop. And that's going to be true for the whole symphony? Really? It drives me crazy. In my own first novel, The Wild Shore, which does this, it drives me crazy. I can't read my own first novel because I hadn't figured all this stuff out. What you want is a conductor that is making time flow like Patrick O'Brien or like Virginia Woolf, like Garcia Marquez. And these, of course, are very, very great writers, but anybody can do it if they've got the concept, if they've thought to themselves, there is no one valid kind of style. There are no rules in fiction. It's interesting if it's interesting. It's interesting if you can make it interesting. And sometimes, like people will say this, I've seen it all the time, Robinson, he's crazy. He spent 25 pages describing a rock on Mars. And they will say this as if it was literally true. And what happened is there was maybe 3 paragraphs in a row describing a rock on Mars, and it has blasted their mind because it seems so out of place. It seems like so much. And maybe it was a little too much, you know? But I'm thinking one of the things you want out of your novelists is that they are crazy, that you're in the hands of a maniac. The Ancient Mariner has grabbed you. They know what they want to say. They say it. They've got command of the situation, and they are not going to play by the rules. So you read Dostoevsky, you read Melville, you're thinking, oh my God, this is just dreadful. And then you realize you're caught up in a world that is inexpressible unless you do all the things that they did. By ignoring the MFA modern workshop style. Hugh Kenner calls the modernist period the Pound Era, because Ezra Pound was so influential. And this was pre-academia. There's a very good book on the MFA writing programs called The Program Era. And it's about how dominated American fiction is by MFA writing programs, and how I could, if I was a cruel person, which I'm not, I could cut out pages from five or six really excellent novels by really excellent writers, read them to you, and you would not be able to tell who was who. And this is sad. So although I have written some very slow-paced, bizarre, strange novels, at least when you're reading a Kim Stanley Robinson novel, you're going, oh God, you know, here I am again. Why do I do this to myself? And yet there you are. And it's the oddity and the difference and the sense of rhythm. So let's keep that in mind, and I think I have come to, yeah, I think that's good. I think I can just conclude with the idea of a call for tolerance, but also let's start paying attention to novels and see, is it a metronome or a conductor, and how fast or slow are they going, and see if we can find some limit cases that are, you know, faster than Pincher Martin or slower than Stapleton or whatever. However, maybe the adjectives should be reversed even. Who knows how to tell this stuff? But if as something to pay attention to, I find it a huge addition to one's experience of all kinds of literature. So, how about some questions from the audience? Oh, well, I tell you what. As a finale, I'll take some questions. And we'll go right to 8:59, unless people just really want to bust out of here and get dinner, which I would understand. But before we leave, I want to read one more paragraph from Star Maker to send us out into a world. But first questions, and then I beg your indulgence to hear one more paragraph before we depart into the night. If there aren't questions, in which case, if there aren't, yes?
You spoke a lot about scale of time. Any comments about scale locality, which also is a big part of Stapleton?
Well, time, space, I guess they're tied together. He asked about space, expanses of space. And I guess I have a response to that, which is, here's what I'm going to say. We're never going to get out of the solar system. Space opera is a form of fantasy literature. And so there's a bubble around us that is approximately the orbit of Neptune that is the human space. It's a neighborhood. It's big in human terms. It's small in universal terms. And so this is a case that I'll be talking more about in World Cons to come, because next year my novel is a Starship novel, so we can talk about that more later. Thank you. I mean, please. Yes?
I don't have a question. I have a statement. If your novels are half as good as your delivery, I can't wait to get my hands on them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Well, you'll have to try one and see, because I can't really say. One thing about novels is, you know that poker game where there's a card that's on your forehead facing outward, and everybody else can see what it is, but you can't? That's the novel. I don't really know. So I need people to, you know, they're looking at you and they're going... Yes?
Did you say the correspondence is unpublished? I just wondered how you came across it.
Oh, yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, the letters, collected letters of Virginia Woolf don't include these letters to Stapleton. They're in the University of Liverpool Stapleton collection. And Andy Sawyer, are you still here, Andy? He helped me to find them. He was curator and head of that program. There is a biography of Stapleton that included one line saying, he even got a nice note from Virginia Woolf, and it mistranscribed elated as excited. But other than that, I was looking at that, and I was, as in most of my life, in a Virginia Woolf phase. I love Virginia Woolf's writing. I think she was the great, she certainly was the great English modernist, but without a question, but she was one of the greatest writers of all time. And as I say, her diary is superb, and her essays are superb, and her novels, each one is an experiment. So I was reading her, and I was thinking, she wrote to Stapleton? Because I love Star Maker in Last and First Men. So then I said, well, where would that be? I contacted the biographer. He said it was in Liverpool. And then I asked Andy Sawyer. And I also, Malcolm Edwards said, will you give a blurb for Star Maker? And I said, Malcolm, not only will I give you a blurb for Star Maker, but I'll give you a blurb from Virginia Woolf for Star Maker. Malcolm's going, if you can do that, that's a good thing. So I'm sitting around, and this is back in the days of fax machines. It must have been the early 90s. My fax machine starts to chatter away. I went over to it, and it's coming up, you know, as it did, very slowly. And it says, 1 Tavistock Square, London, W1. And the hair rose on the back of my neck. I was getting a fax from Virginia Woolf. Oh, my God, it's like, I've loved her so much that she's come back to say hi. It was a great moment. And I still have that very fax on my wall in a framed copy that is now completely faded. Because it came up and said, Dear Mr. Stapleton. And it was the letter from July of 37. So I think there should be an article, a short article, published in the Virginia Woolf journals saying, look, you've missed these letters, and they're pretty great. And I think I should write it, but I don't know. Writing nonfiction is just a very, very painful exercise. Someday I might do it. Maybe one more question, and then we'll read and go at the back. Or we'll have two more questions. What the hell? Or even three.
A lot of science fiction as a pacing effect, time dilation
in relativistic time. Yeah. How does that tie into it? Well, relativistic time dilation has created some really great stories. Joe Haldeman, Stanislaw Lem, Return from the Stars. It does require you going very close to the speed of light. And one of the things that I have been noticing in my work on starships is you get yourself close to the speed of light in an object as big as a starship, try slowing it down. You got a problem, serious problem. So it does make a great story thing, and also time travel itself. I used to say time travel is just a fantasy element, but so what? If you get a time travel idea, which I did with Galileo's Dream, you kind of have to write it as crazy as it is, and not be so hardcore. Galileo's Dream taught me that as a science fiction writer who is usually disparaging about fantasy, I need to shut up. What I really mean is, anything goes if you can make it work. It's just that I'm sick of really long, bloated, high fantasy novels. And so my one fantasy novel, A Short, Sharp Shock, is 36,000 words long, and you can read it over lunch. It was my thoughtful idea, which has obviously not been taken up by anybody else. Yes?
There is a book called Time and Western Man by Wyndham Lewis that has certain themes of my story.
I haven't read that book, but Wyndham Lewis is really one of the most interesting English modernists. Very cranky, very hard to read. But I think he was acquainted with J.W. Dunn, who wrote An Experiment with Time about precognitive dreams. And I thoroughly recommend An Experiment with Time, which is a much shorter book and easier to read than Wyndham Lewis by a long shot. If any of you keep a dream journal, you may have noticed that every once in a while you'll write down a dream, and the next day or that day, the thing will happen. And essentially, you have to say, that's quite a coincidence, or what the hell, because it's hard to imagine it not being synchronicity or precognition, but it also could just be that coincidences happen a lot, because every night we have a dream life that if you had to write it all down, would be maybe 500 or 800 pages worth of dream narrative, when we seldom remember more than a half page. So maybe it's just a coincidence. But this book, An Experiment with Time by J.W. Dunn, is a wonderful book. All right, how about one last question, and then I want to read. Well, are we okay for two questions? Let's do these two questions, you and then at the back. Michael? Is it Michael?
Yeah.
And at the back, and then I'm going to read, and then we're going to go.
Very good point, just in terms of that time thing, what really reminds me of what you're talking about is the Rings of science fiction, like Stephen Baxter. He does that really well. Epic, low, and then slows it right down for those books, like his stories. And I think it's really that's great. So that's what resonates with me. Maybe somebody asked about space, and I wonder, what tricks do authors play to space to get the same kind of effect? I mean, you get lots of stories which have multiple narratives, but for me, a lot of what science fiction is about the epic kind of feel to it, where characters are in much wider events.
Right.
And are there similar tricks that kind of, with the narrative and the pacing, that work over space?
The question is again about space and how you might manipulate it to get the big scales. You've got a string of sentences, and so I think it works differently. When you do description, that's one of those expository sections that you have to be very careful not to overwhelm people and try to be suggestive rather than exhaustive. And you can try to describe big scenes, but then you get into generalities. And so I would say that it's really hard, that this is one of the areas where movies, because movies have enormous powers in the area that they have powers. They can't do the summary of time, like he worked 10 years like a dog and he never got anywhere. A movie, the only example I can think of, you know, you have the calendars ripping off with the wind going by them in the 30s. That's what they have to do to indicate time passing. But there's a rather stupid movie called Notting Hill with Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant. And Hugh Grant walks through Notting Hill Market and four seasons pass as he walks. So that they manage to imply a year has passed in a visual image that's quite beautiful. And considering that the movie was your ordinary dumb romantic comedy with those two guys, it was kind of miraculous to have this one great scene where movies are suddenly doing something different with time. But as for space, many times, like if you think of the big battle, the battles at the end of The Lord of the Rings, the sense of spaciousness and your comprehension of different forces, that's where one word at a time can't really compete. Anybody who was at my reading this afternoon where I have this artificial intelligence trying to decide how do you sequence information has realized the novelist's problem. It has to be one word at a time. So implying space is a weird problem. Okay, last question at the back.
Just going to say I'm standing here deeply regretting this news to your talk.
Thank you.
Is there anywhere I can find out what you've seen?
Find which book?
About this, somewhere that I can read, find out what you were
saying. Oh no, this is a private event between us, man. This is a talk. And I kind of love that. This is a talk that I have tried to give repeatedly, and I'm glad that it went well tonight by focusing in on the various elements that I like. But it's never been recorded, and there's an inverse relationship with how well I do and how likely it is to get on YouTube. So that, if I did bad, it's going to be on YouTube. If I did well, nobody will have filmed it. So this is maybe one of those cases, but I think it's better that way. I mean, we had an event. It was live theater. It's not going to be on YouTube, and we get to share it together and then move on. I mean, it's kind of more, more Zen to think. You can't really hold on to anything, and so maybe I'll give it again someday, or people can tell you it. So I want to finish, and one of the reasons I want to finish is, although you got to remember, Star Maker was written in 1937, and the Dogs of War were already very much nearly off the leash. And so for him to write this generally hopeful book in 1937 was a political gesture and an emotional gesture. And yet, this paragraph, it seems to me, is very... it's still very... you'll see. It seems to still work for us. The whole planet, the whole rock grain, with its busy swarms, I now saw as an arena where two cosmical antagonists, two spirits, were already preparing for a critical struggle, already assuming terrestrial and local guise and coming to grips in our half-awakened minds. In city upon city, in village after village, and in innumerable lonely farmsteads, cottages, hovels, shacks, huts, in all the crevices where human creatures were intent on their little comforts and triumphs and escapes, the great struggle of our age was brewing. One antagonist appeared as the will to dare for the sake of the new, the longed for, the reasonable and joyful world in which every man and woman may have scope to live fully and live in service of mankind. The other seemed essentially the myopic fear of the unknown, Or was it more sinister? Was it the cunning will for private mastery, which fomented for its own ends the archaic, reason-hating, and vindictive passions of the tribe? It seemed that in the coming storm, all the dearest things must be destroyed. All private happiness, all loving, all creative work in art, science, and philosophy, all intellectual scrutiny and speculative imagination, and all creative social building, all indeed that man should normally live for, seemed folly and mockery and mere self-indulgence in the presence of public calamity. But if we failed to preserve them, when would they live again? How to face such an age? How to muster courage, being capable only of homely virtues? How to do this, yet preserve the mind's integrity, never to let the struggle destroy in one's own heart what one tried to serve in the world, the spirit's integrity? Stapled.